This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your numbers are 877-217-5757. Wherever you are, locally in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. And you can always send us an email at talk@talklouisiana.org. Our leadoff guest is Professor John Entine. He's at Cal Davis and is head of the Genetic Literacy Project. And 17 years ago, he caused quite a stir with his book Taboo, which analyzed racial differences in athletics. As UCLA professor Jared Diamond has noted, few scientists dare to study racial origins lest they be branded racist for just bringing up the topic. And it is a sensitive topic, but one that I think is warranted in our time. And good morning to you, John Entine.
Good morning, Jim. Glad to be back on your show, actually.
Yeah, it's been, I think, 17 years, but I remember our discussion well. And you go back all the way to 1989 with a documentary with Tom Brokaw about this very subject. And every time you bring this subject up, it has some pushback. Why do you think people are so reluctant to embrace this topic?
Well, you know, we're talking about racial differences, and we're talking about genetics. And I think there's a clear pattern. We'll discuss this over the next, few minutes in performance differences in between blacks and whites. But when you start discussing racial differences, it raises all kinds of historical red flags, intellectual differences, capabilities, categorizing Jews or Catholics or other groups based on race. So there's a really sordid history. And we have to make sure that when we discuss these things, we discuss them, you know, through the prism of science and not let a lot of prejudices and folklore really discolor what's a pretty straightforward argument and discussion in many ways.
Well, I know of no one who's more knowledgeable and has put more effort into this topic than you. And based on all these years of research by you, is it your impression that athletic differences among the races are related to genetics or environment?
Well, I think it's a biocultural phenomenon. There's no question that body type and physiology, how you metabolize energy, all that is not individual. There are population tendencies, and it's not really race when you really look at it through the prism of science. You look at Africa and West Africans and East Africans have very, very different body types, everything from musculature to lung size. So it's really different populations. I feel much more comfortable using that word than race, even though that's the word that's kind of generally used. But there's also no question that cultural factors play a huge role. I mean, for decades, there were no black ice hockey players. And to think that blacks couldn't play ice hockey is absurd. But ice hockey hadn't become popular in areas where there was a black population. Now there's a fairly sizable number of black players in the NHL. So clearly there's a mixture of cultural and genetic factors.
Well, it cuts both ways as far as particular talents that have definite racial trends. I mentioned as a lead into today's show that 84% of the LSU football team that will suit up Saturday night is African American. This is at a university that 45 years ago was just breaking the color barrier in the football program. But at the same time, you note that among weightlifting competition in the Olympics, that has been dominated in a huge way by Caucasians. So it cuts both ways, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. I still remember, by the way, Laura Hinton making his debut at LSU in 71.
He was on the show here just a few weeks ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's very cool. There are differences, and I actually will use the NFL as a good example. People are familiar with the NFL Combine every February in Indianapolis, where all the top college seniors are kind of screened before the draft. And you can look at the stats on that, and it's kind of startlingly interesting. You look at the 40-yard dash time this past year, and every single one of the top 50 40-yard dash times were held by a person of African ancestry, and they're all of West African ancestry. But you look at the weightlifting, the presses, the fast press time, which is another measurement that they do, and about 80% of them were held by whites. And to assume that somehow blacks aren't trying to be good weightlifters or whites aren't trying to be good at the 40-yard dash is just absurd. There are certain generalized body characteristics that are more prevalent in one population group than another, and at the elite level, not at the everyday level in many things, but at the elite level, that those differences really are pretty apparent.
We're visiting with John Entine. He heads the Genetic Literacy Project at the University of California, Davis, and has spent much of his career analyzing ethnic and racial distinctions among athletes. And here's a question: why are East Africans so dominant in distance running, and why are West Africans so dominant in elite sprints?
It's a fascinating question. If you look at running in general, every single running record of note in the world, on the men's side, is held by a person of African ancestry. On the women's side, there are a few whites that still hold records. Most of them are legacies, I think, of the Eastern European drug system. They're times that probably will never be repeated, and they were probably pumped by anabolic steroids. But on the men's side, everyone is of African ancestry, but there's a dramatic split. All the sprint record times up until 400 meters are held by a person of West African ancestry, and from 800 meters on, they're all of East African ancestry, or in a couple of cases, North African ancestry. There's a clear difference in body type because of evolutionary factors. People from East Africa, the ones who are the great long-distance runners, for instance, all grew up, evolved historically over literally thousands of years in hill territory and in mountainous territory. And things like that have a dramatic effect on muscle fiber type and lung capacity, and it just shows up at the elite level.
Your book, Taboo, as noted, was published in 2000, and 17 years later, I hear it's still generating attention, and lots of copies are sold every year. I would think somebody else would have tackled this topic beyond you in the last 17 years, but it appears on this particular topic, John Entine, you're the man.
Well, it's taboo. It still remains that way. There's no way that you cannot, I recognize that, especially with all the racial tension that we have in our society, that that people can misuse pretty straightforward science information. They misuse it all the time when it comes to, like, intellectual ability, for instance. Fascinating. A lot of what my book was about was the history of race. It wasn't just about sports and the misuse of the race concept. And you go back to the early 20th century, when black athletes were just beginning to have an opportunity because of all racial prejudice, and all the top athletes who were African-American were from elite Ivy League and state schools like Ohio State, where Jesse Owens went. And the idea of blacks being considered intellectually inferior and that there was an inverse relationship between being a good athlete and being smart was just absurd. But now it's different, and I think these things are dangerous. And, you know, I stuck my foot in the water 17 years ago. I could tell you it was pretty hot.
It was
rough for a while.
Very hot. Now, LSU, as I noted, has a roster that's 84% African American. And if we were to look at the University of Alabama, it would be close to that for football. And yet, when you look at the coaches, particularly head coaches in college football, it's still largely a white society. When will that change?
Well, it's changed a lot over the past 20 years in professional football especially, and I think in good college football programs. I don't know specifically about LSU or Alabama's program, but I know that in most college football programs now, there's a fair number of assistant black coaches. There are not nearly so many head coaches, and I think there's far more in the NFL, for instance, percentage-wise, than there are in college football at the elite level, which is kind of amazing. So there is a residue of, I think, prejudice about those kinds of things. And I just you know, there's all kinds of factors that go into what makes a head coach, and one of them is the buddy system and relationships, and those things still haven't been built to the point that I think, you know, African-American coaches get a fair shot.
Well, it would seem that that would be a natural evolution, but there is always the concern that here we have these athletes who presumably are getting books, board, and tuition, and they're the ones who are the gladiators on the field, and the coaches who are earning now multi-million dollar contracts, even assistant coaches, and most of them remain Caucasian. When will that change? We'll talk about this and more with John Entine, director of the Genetic Literacy Project at the University of California, Davis, and author of Taboo. 877-217-5757. We'll go to the phone lines after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar is producing, and your numbers again, 877-217-5757, and in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. You can email us, talk@talklouisiana.org. Our guest is John Entine, who heads the Genetic Literacy Project at the University of California, Davis. His 2000 book was Taboo, and the subtitle, Why Black Athletes Dominate Sports and Why We're Afraid to Talk About It. Well, we're talking about it right here, and if you'd like to join the conversation again, 877-217-5757, Charlotte in New Iberia. Good morning, Charlotte. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. The Weight Watchers were mentioned earlier in the other segment. Are the Weight Watchers represented by concentration of descendants from Germany, Russia?
Weightlifters, versus, you mean? Weightlifters?
Yes, yes. What did I say?
Weight Watchers.
Weight Watchers. Oh, excuse me. Weightlifters versus, well, are they represented by people descended from Germans or Russians versus Spaniards, English, or Australian ancestry?
All right.
That's a very good question, and actually you're kind of on to something. It's by the way, it wouldn't really be ancestry from a certain country. It would be from a certain region, obviously, because of we're talking about evolutionary factors that unfolded over literally thousands of years. But the body type that tends to do well in things like weightlifting or the shot put or the javelin throw, all the field events that you see in the Olympics tend to be Eurasian athletes. So they tend to be Eastern European on the edge of Asia. So it would be perhaps some of the areas in Germany. But again, there's been movement of people, and these are not distinct circles or population groups. There's a lot of overlap here, and we're talking about things in the macro level. In other words, you could say that men are taller than women, but it doesn't mean that they're not really, really tall women. And there's plenty of people from all different racial population backgrounds that do well in any sport. But when you look at the elite level, the numbers tend to show that Eurasian athletes tend to dominate in the weight events.
Often people note that back many decades ago that Jewish Americans dominated basketball, and they use this as a way of showing some kind of ethnic distinction. Was that an anomaly, or is that something that is valid to today's discussion?
Yeah, it is kind of valid in a certain kind of way. We talked about that in the book, and also it was part of the documentary beginning in the late 19-teens and into the 1930s, the top basketball players in the United States were Jews and also blacks. The Jews were ghetto kids. Protestants generally didn't play the sport. Jews and Catholics did, and Jews were kind of dominant. The number one team was the Philadelphia Hebrews. South Philadelphia Hebrew Association team, the Cleveland Rosenblums, they were a great team. And they played in Barnstorm with teams like the New York Celtics, which was a black team, and the Globetrotters before they became the cartoon team that they were. But there was really almost all cultural. It was a ghetto sport, and it was a way for the Jews and Catholics to make their way out of the ghetto. And when the playing field got leveled in the 1950s, when blacks were post-World War II, began to have an opportunity to go into the sport, and a lot of Protestants came into the sport, especially in the Midwest, the look of basketball changed, and it went from being a Catholic and Jewish sport to just an every person's sport. So there it almost just shows the cultural factors also play a role. But now we have a level playing field in most sports, the ones we're talking about. And when the playing field is level, natural ability comes to the fore.
I recall a few years ago, Carl Lewis sitting right here in this studio, and he at that time was serious. He said he was going to start running marathons. It didn't work out so well for him. And he, of course, was one of the great athletes of all time. Usain Bolt, brilliant athlete, maybe the greatest athlete of his generation of any sport. But my guess is that if he or Carl had started out wanting to be a marathon runner, that they would have had difficulty competing at the same levels they did in sprinting.
Well, that's what the statistics show. You look at the top 500 100-meter times, all but two of them are held by a person of West African ancestry. The other two are whites. And you look at the top 100 marathon times, there's not one West African. So this body type difference, East Africans having large lung capacity, having a higher proportion of soft twitch, of slow twitch muscles, which are really good for endurance, having this spindly and fairly short body type versus West Africans who were speedsters, but much more musculature than East Africans. So the divide is pretty strong. No, I don't think that they could have made it as long distance runners.
And one of your colleagues, Robert Molina of Michigan State, he says the fraction of a second is the difference between the gold medal and fourth place.
Sure. I mean, you know, you might not see these stark differences, let's say, on a high school team, even though you do see some of these trends. But as you climb the elite ladder, the smallest differences mean tremendous differences in terms of who's an elite athlete and who's an also-ran.
Well, why is it so difficult to discuss this without bringing in the intellectual distinctions, if there are any? Is that a totally different subject?
I don't think it's totally different. I mean, there's no question that we are shaped by our evolutionary factors, but the things that contribute to intellectual ability, it's so complex. There's so many factors. There's so many genes involved. The brain is so big, and it just takes up so much of our genetic and energy composition that to compare that to, you know, the length of limbs or the size of lungs just doesn't pan out. So could there be factors and even things like temperament, perhaps? It's possible. We just don't have the sophistication to make that kind of analysis right now. But we do in sports, and we have running happens to be the most level playing field of any sport. But we also see it in football. On LSU is a great example. I don't think the breakdown would be 84-16 in terms of what it really is. I think that football has become a black sport, meaning that it's become the sport in the African-American community along with basketball. And, you know, 50 years ago it was different. It was baseball, and now there's fewer African-Americans going into baseball and much more going into football and basketball.
Well, the players are much bigger now. LSU, for example, has 18 players above 300 pounds, one who weighs 380. Is that a factor?
Yeah, sure. I mean, well, that's almost unfathomable. I don't even understand that. I haven't studied it enough to know how you can be that big. But what's so remarkable about the athletes that you're talking about is they're not only huge, they're fast. And I think that's a difference. The speed factor is just not there. There might be, you know, a couple examples, but generally speaking, the speed factor isn't there with whites. So you have these huge, huge bodies. But for their size, they still have these fast twitch muscles, and they're able to just be explosive as linemen or defensive linebackers or whatever position they're playing.
And a listener notes that in the 50s and early 60s, players played on both sides of the ball, basically played the whole game. If that were to happen, I would imagine the talent would be much different than it is now. Some of these big guys just couldn't play. They couldn't stay on the
Absolutely.
Field that long.
Yeah, there's no question about that.
Well, what do you think will be the biggest hurdle in embracing this topic as we move forward?
Well, again, I think as long as there is the kind of racial tensions that we have in our society, and it's been, you know, exacerbated this year, as we all know, I think this is a subject that just people don't want to talk about. But when it comes to sports differences, scientists have really come around. When I first wrote Taboo, many of the scientists were on the record making the points that I was making, but some who knew what the issue was were unwilling to talk about it. But that's changing, and I think it's changed forever.
Well, thank you, John Entine, director of the Sports Literacy Project, Genetic Literacy Project at California Davis, and also the author of Taboo, Why Black Athletes Dominate Sports and Why We're Afraid to Talk About It. Now the news with Karen Henderson on 89.3 WRKF.
Louisiana Radio Network News, I'm Michelle Southern. The general election for state treasurer is a month away. Three Republican candidates are raising money. There's also a Democrat and Libertarian on the ballot. Publisher of LawPolitics.com, Jeremy Alford, says none of the candidates have enough money to run TV commercials statewide, which will lead to a low voter turnout on October 14th.
Secretary of State Tom Scheller has already predicted that turnout will likely be less than 20%.
Early voting begins September 30th. Higher Education Commissioner Joe Rallo says the first LostSTEM Advisory Council meeting was successful. He says they're discussing ways to get more students to succeed in science, technology, engineering, and math jobs, and a push to get more women into these careers.
Women who go into the STEM fields actually make more than men in comparable positions. So this is not just altruism, it's not just nice to have, but it would also go and close that wage gap.
He says the council agrees STEM education needs to be a pipeline, starting in kindergarten and continuing through high school. Louisiana Radio Network.com.
And they lived happily ever after. The end.
That's how a lot of fairy tales end, but this is the SEC. It's far from a fairy tale. It's Tiger football. It doesn't get any more real. And this is what Tiger Rag magazine lives and breathes. The stories you find nowhere else. Not fairy tales, not stories spoon-fed by the athletic department. Behind-the-scenes stories, the stories that put you in the know.
Oh, now that's hot.
Get Tiger Rag Magazine. Get the stories your friends will be talking about. Subscribe now online at TigerRag.com or call Tiger Rag Magazine at 888-328-4437. Tiger Rag Magazine and TigerRag.com. Stories and insights that put you in the know.
Once upon a time.
No fairy tale stories. Tiger Rag Magazine stories. Call 888-328-4437.
The end.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number. Baton Rouge number is 297-5633. We're joined by Dr. Joffrey Mountvarner. He is a leader in national health care who speaks nationally and internationally on matters related to his field. He served for several years as the chief of a Level 1 trauma center in Washington, D.C., and has had several appointed leadership positions in the nation's capital. And his book is Home Alive, 11 Must Rules for Surviving Encounters with the Police. Good morning, Dr. Varner.
Good morning, Jim, and thank you for having me.
Joffrey Mountvarner is our guest, and the book is it's a compelling book, and it's largely directed at problems that sometimes occur when African-American young men are stopped by the police, and you have experienced this personally. How so?
Well, just as you just highlight, I am an African-American male, and I've been pulled over several times. And what I've learned after being around for like 50 years now is that there's a way to interact with police officers. But most of my lessons have really come from my 20 years of ER experience and seen it from a number of different perspectives.
Well, is it a big problem or is it a small problem or somewhere in between?
Well, depends on how you define problem. If you're the person pulled over, then yes. But the data, which is new, is very clear that we have a national crisis in terms of the interactions of officers and black males, but officers and citizens just as a whole as well.
877-217-5757 for Dr. Geoffrey Mount Varner of Howard University, graduate of Harvard, by the way. His book is Home Alive, 11 Must Rules for Surviving Encounters with the Police. So if a young black man is pulled over, as, say, opposed to a young white man, and there is a discussion that ensues, which is common, what's the best way to handle this for the young man who's pulled over?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. But just to clarify, I think that during the initial, I think that anyone who is pulled over, black, white, purple, or yellow, there is an initial period of angst when you are pulled over. Just so happened, disproportionately, black males are impacted by that angst. But to your question, when pulled over, you've got to control the controllables, meaning you've got to control yourself because you can't control the officer, but you can set a tone. And number one, it's very important to make sure that the officer feels safe. Again, it's not about you. It's about making sure the officer feels safe first.
And how is that done?
How is that done is, well, you know, Jim, things have changed since we grew up. I know that when I was taught to drive, I was taught that if the officer pulls you over, you reach down in your glove compartment to grab your ID. But now, no, things have changed. If you're pulled over, you don't reach for anything. You keep your hands on the steering wheel, and you look forward. If your windows are tinted before the officer even gets there, let down all the windows so that the officer, again, feels safe. And if it's at night, turn on the light on the inside so that we create a mood of safety for the officer, because that will help de-escalate the situation, because the goal is to get home alive.
And officers are now under a kind of scrutiny perhaps they were not before. And many people have these phones that videotape what's going on. What kind of pressures are they facing now?
Well, I think that first and foremost, officers have always and still do face an enormous amount of pressure, because after all, their job is to protect American citizens. And my research is very clear. The bulk of officers are good, law-abiding, loving citizens who want to do the right thing. But they also have their own interests. They want to make it home alive, too. So anything we can do to help them make it home alive, and one thing is de-escalating this situation before it even escalates. Because after all, we all want to survive today so that we can thrive tomorrow.
All right, 877-217-5757, and talk at talklouisiana.org for Dr. Geoffrey Mount Varner, whose book is Home Alive, 11 Must Rules for Surviving Encounters with Police. Tom in Baton Rouge asks about giving the police officer the benefit of the doubt, but when is that benefit of the doubt no longer appropriate? At what point does a citizen fight back, if you will?
I'm not sure if I understand the question, but what I will say, I don't think that there's ever a time during the scene that you fight back an officer, because that officer is licensed to kill you, and if that officer feels a threat, they are licensed to take appropriate action. So from my perspective, and as an ER doctor whose whole goal is to save lives, there's never a time on the scene to fight an officer. Now, once you get home alive, there are steps that you can take to address what happened on the scene.
Stuart in South Baton Rouge. Stuart, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Dr. Geoffrey Mount Varner. Hi, Stuart.
Yes, gentlemen, good morning. One of my, and not only myself, but the cocoon that I live in, And it consists, it's a very racially diverse cocoon, by the way, just about of every ethnicity on the planet. So let's get that straight, since race is such a horrific ingredient in discussions of this magnitude, particularly black and white. the better educated citizens are completely tired of these barely got out of high school idiots who we arm with badges and guns and cars with circus lights, and the enormous amount of authority that they have to either conduct themselves equitably or ridiculously. And I think we need to have a much better educated officer. When you have officers who have matriculated their way through Backwood Elementary, Backwood Middle, and Backwood High School, and then they thrust themselves onto a police department where they are compelled to interact with every ethnicity on the planet. These people, the ones that are, and the vast majority of them, particularly Caucasian officers, come from this background. And God bless the ones who've gone to the military. Then they want to come home and treat us like we're Al-Qaeda. These people, they ought to be forced to go to college, because matriculating at the collegiate level forces them to interact with ethnicities that otherwise they probably would not have the opportunity to interact with. And they.
All right. Thank you, Stuart. I want you to respond, Dr. Mountbarner.
So, Stuart, thank you for your very passionate comment. And let me say this, that there is a training issue that needs to happen. And that is going to take years. But what I do know is that 3.4 Americans are killed each day. So while we are going through while we are developing permanent solutions, we need temporary fixes that will immediately start saving lives. And as part of my book, we offer these 12 steps, or these 11 steps, excuse me. But let me just say, the steps are not ideal. They can even make you feel uncomfortable. But the goal is to survive the encounter. You and your child's life depends on you surviving the encounter.
877-217-5757 and talk@talklouisiana.org in our remaining moments with Dr. Joffrey Mountbarner, Home Alive, 11 must rules for surviving encounters with the police. Is it worse now than it was before, or we always had these problems?
Jim, that is an excellent question. It is difficult to say, especially when you combine the fact that it wasn't until 2015 and 2016 that we got reliable data in terms of police deaths. But what is clear is that moving forward, combined with the heightened media attention and with the prevalence of like video cameras, that we are likely to see more of it, but we don't have a control group to say whether or not it's getting better or worse. But what we do know is that citizens are being killed daily. In fact, 30% of those killed by the police were unarmed. In fairness to officers, 1 in 5 of those killed by officers were firing shots back. So we have an American crisis that's going to take an American effort to fix. But part of that effort is, when you're pulled over, your goal is to make it home alive.
Yeah, I would think so. And sometimes it does not happen. And how does it usually go awry?
It often goes awry by miscommunication and misunderstanding. I think that to move the public forward swiftly, if we just accept that from the moment an officer pulls you over, any activism you may have ceases at that moment. Because at that moment, the officer has all the power. They have all the authority at that moment. You making it home alive changes that. Then whatever happened during that stop that was not correct, there are mechanisms and ways to address that. And then sometimes, unfortunately, things go awry because officers may not know how to respond to citizens, and citizens may not know how to respond to like officers. And that's why many states are moving towards training programs of how to interact with officers once pulled over.
The book is Home Alive, 11 Must Rules for Surviving Encounters with the Police, from Dr. Joffrey Mountbarner, and we thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure. Certainly an important.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Take care. Dr. Joffrey Mountbarner. We're joined next by John Wirt and Ben Bell. Big night for the 70s tonight at the Hartley Bay Theater. We'll find out why after this quick timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number. It's Nostalgia Night at the Hartley Bay Theater downtown at the Shaw Center. And it's particularly nostalgia about the 70s. And that's the theme, Jukebox Music and Musicology, tonight at 7:30. And we're talking with Ben Bell and John Wirt about this. And Ben, this has been kind of your baby. And tell us how this came about. Good morning, Ben.
Well, good morning, Jim. Good morning, sir. I was working singer-songwriter here in Baton Rouge, and I just had developed an intellectual curiosity for the 70s. The music, you know, I grew up in the 70s. I was born in 69. So just the music sticks with me. You know, I play classic country and swing and folky originals and so forth, but I can't escape the 70s. And I just had an intellectual curiosity about, you know, why it sticks with me. And I was getting philosophical about it, I guess, and wanted to discuss it with other musicians and make music.
The show features local musicians tackling classical songs of the 1970s era, well as discussions and anecdotes with John Wirt, who is also with us, the music critic, who's been doing this for a long time. And John, the 70s quite often are not revered in the same way as the 60s were as far as music. Was it an underrated decade?
Well, if somebody's going to say the 70s were a lesser decade for music, that's not really true, because the 70s were an incredible period for the singer-songwriters, and you saw the beginning of heavy metal with Black Sabbath, and then you saw people from the 60s go on and make some of their greatest work, such as the Rolling Stones. People generally rate Exile on Main Street from 72 as the greatest Rolling Stones album. And Exile on Main Street, by the way, features a song by Baton Rouge's own Slim Harpo. But that's an aside. Yeah, it was a great decade for music, and it's really remarkable when you look at the albums that were released in that period. It's just an incredible legacy of music.
Ben, you said you were born in 1969. What do you remember about 70s music? Who were some of the artists you recall?
The first song I remember liking, I was 4 years old, 4 or 5, I remember Take Me Home, Country Roads. I remember growing up, it's sincere, it might be corny, but, you know, I'm not going to hide from that anymore. But I remember Alone Again Naturally by Gilbert O'Sullivan.
Yeah.
As a brilliant melody.
Number one.
You know,
yeah.
I remember growing up with disco and punk, and then getting into the 80s and then the 90s, and just listening to all the changes, you know, what the 70s, you know, what was before the 70s and how did the 70s change music? And, you know, this, I'm interested in all that.
Well, our producer, Ali Baltazar, was born in the 90s, but she has selected some 70s music. I'm curious to hear what she has come up with. What's your first selection from the 1970s, Ali Baltazar? It sounds like Gordon Lightfoot. Early
70s. You could read my love.
That would be, if you could read my mind, I bet.
All right, let him go a little while. Let's hear a little more of that.
In a castle dark or a fortress strong with chains upon my feet, you know that ghost is me, and I will never be set free as long as I.
Well, Gordon Lightfoot had a remarkable career, folk singer, a genre that has not been celebrated as much as it should, although it is every Saturday night on WRKF by our friend Taylor Caffrey. But John Wirt, Gordon Lightfoot, he was one of the big artists of the 70s. Allie made a pretty good selection.
Yes, he had a nice career, and his songs, you know, the emotion and the craft involved, and the honesty, that's characteristic of the 70s singer-songwriters, such as James Taylor. He would sing these very painful personal songs, and that goes for Carole King and Neil Young. And something else that happened, you had the solo Paul Simon in the 70s. So Harry Chapin, the great storyteller, who would also tell very deep stories that were, you know, really poignant. So
Jim Croce.
Gordon Lightfoot is a good example.
Yeah, Jim Croce, who died September 20th, 1973 in Natchitoches after performing at Northwestern State. He was 44 years coming up in a few days. But he was only 30 years old. What a tragedy that we lost that man. Yeah. He was fabulous.
Were you a 70s fan, Jim?
Well, yeah, I was a 70s fan. I was in high school, and I was in college when Allie's Next Selection was popular. And this is a song that obviously is synonymous with the late 1970s. All right, the Bee Gees, 1977-78.
Put your dancing shoes on, Jim.
Yeah, I remember seeing that movie at the old Robert E. Lee Theater on Plank Road. I walked in, and there was a statue of Robert E. Lee and a rebel flag right there on Plank Road, and I saw Saturday Night Fever with John Travolta. He looked
rebel
pretty good
flag
in that film.
Tell about him.
Well, that song in that film, that huge hits, and they just celebrated their 40th anniversary. But, John Wirt, did you like Saturday Night Fever?
Well, you know what? I think I was studying classical music at the time. And believe it or not, I sort of got into my classical music thing and got away from popular music, although I did return to it pretty soon, you know.
Right.
But, the Bee Gees were... They totally reinvented themselves because they're another example of a 60s group that went into the 70s and created their most classic work. A lot of people would say it's certainly their most popular work, which would be the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever.
Apparently, they kind of they didn't like the fact that they were being pigeonholed with Stayin' Alive becoming a signature song, you know, because they were real pop, you know. They were deep musicians.
And there were other huge hits on that album in addition to...
Yeah.
Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah.
There was Night Fever. Saturday Night Live.
Night Fever.
What? And How Deep Is Your Love? Yeah. Which was a huge hit. Huge hit. But, Ben, you were only, what, second, third grade when that movie came out, Saturday Night Fever.
I remember being in elementary school in Austin, Texas. I might have been in third, fourth grade, something like that. So, yeah.
All right, a listener says the 70s gave us the Eagles and the Bee Gees and Steely Dan. So those were not bad groups.
ABBA.
Talk about fusion, yeah.
Pretty good stuff.
Oh, the Eagles fused country and pop and Steely Dan, jazz and pop. And wow.
Well, the Eagles released... I think it's six albums in the 1970s, including Hotel California. So that was, you know, certainly one of their great decades.
Yeah, well, they were exceptional in that decade, as synonymous with the Eagles. Now, tonight, how many performers will be on stage?
We have three acts. We have Robert Kalmes, who is a classically trained guitarist, great technique, good easygoing style, and then I'm going to be playing with guests Kat Carlson on the upright bass and Margaret Fowler, an R&B soul star here in town, and Kristen Foster. And then we've got chamber folk group headlining the Wilder Janes. They'll be doing a great song, a very popular song on harp tonight. So I think that'll be really interesting to hear.
And John's a tough critic at times, but John, sometimes these people do exceptional work covering these great songs.
Well, I want to say, as Ben said earlier, I don't think we're really covering things tonight. I think these are interpretations. When you have great people who make original music most of the time, then I think that adds to that, because you have even more so the artistry in their interpretations. So this is not a cover band night, and this is something beyond that, because, like, let's say the Baton Rouge Symphony is going to do Beethoven's and Brahms symphonies. They're not covering Beethoven. They're not covering Brahms. You know, they're lending all their expertise to interpretation.
Well, that's a good way of putting it. And come Monday, by the way, on this show, we'll hear from Tim Muffett, the maestro of the Baton Rouge Symphony.
So
he will be right here in studio. But tonight,
ask Tim.
Yeah.
Won't you ask Tim? Is the Baton Rouge Symphony Orchestra a cover band?
That sounds like
you're trying to stir up trouble, John Wirt. So you do that tonight. Save that for this evening at the Hartley Bay Theater, 7:30. It'll be the 70s Jukebox, Music and Musicology. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Good
Thank
luck
you.
Tonight.
Thank you, Jim.
We're back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.